Hello, everybody. This is Noah and John, and we are from Urban Digs. And Johnny, we are talking Manhattan today, and we got James McGrath, co-founder and broker over at Yurivo. And this guy does a bunch of deals out there, John. He's also head of the company, so he sees all the deals flow. He sees all the leads coming in. He sees a lot of angles, gets a lot of data. And of course, if you see a lot of data, we want you on this show. So, James, thank you so much for joining John and
Yeah,
I. And
happy to be here.
I'm gonna dive right in, James, if I can. People want to know, please tell us what is going on out there in the Manhattan or the New York City markets.
As you have indicated in the Digs data and the market updates, we've definitely seen an uptick in activity really over the last 2 months. I mean, in the fall it was pretty quiet, and you had to look no further than the rise in mortgage rates. So for most of the fall we were at 7% plus 7.5, flirting with 8. And it seems like that moderate pullback in rates, even though they're still in the mid sixes these days, was enough to get a lot of buyers off the fence. So definitely in December, well, in December, but then definitely in January and now into February, we've seen a big uptick in the urgency among buyers, the absolute level of activity. And I'm seeing more bidding wars on properties that, frankly, I would just never expect to even sell, let alone have a bidding war. So this isn't just new listings that came onto the market. Obviously, you're always going to have that hot listing, underpriced, et cetera. These are listings that were on the market for 2, 3 months, some with little to no price cut. And just all of a sudden, the buyers are congregating and making offers, and it's getting pushed up. So I always tell buyers that there's always a reasonable range in terms of the pricing for a particular property. And if you're in one of these competitive situations in the fall, you probably could have been a little more conservative with your offer. But given the level of competition, the level of activity these days, you probably want to be a little more aggressive if you really want that property.
That's an interesting take. And let me ask you this, James. I mean, you mentioned the interest rate environment. And one of the things that we've talked about for quite a long time on the show is that there's definitely not a one-to-one correlation in terms of
Course.
interest rates and contracts signed. That I mean, there's so many cash deals signed in Manhattan, so you can't really draw that correlation. However, it is part of the equation. And I'm wondering, you talk about the activities increasing. How much it just rough back of the envelope math, how much of you think of it as due to the lower interest rate environment we're in compared to where we were? And then the follow-up to that is the second question, which is, how sustainable is this right now?
Yeah, I think it's mostly mortgage rates because not much else has really changed. Obviously, I'm looking at this on a year-over-year basis or compared to normalized levels of demand, not versus normal seasonality, which obviously you're always going to have an uptick this time of the year. But as you have documented in your data, the inventory remains tight, but it's not like that has changed much over the last couple of years. And so we are seeing mortgage rates come down, and that seems to be enough to get buyers off of the sidelines. That being said, to your second question, I don't know how sustainable it is, simply because rates are still high, and it just goes to show you how buyers can get anchored to particular rates. Because when we were going up to 6.5%, buyers are saying, "No way, I'm out." But when rates came down to 6.5%, that got them off the sidelines. So I just question how sustainable the demand is. How deep is the buyer pool at a 6.5% rate? Obviously, if rates change, the situation is going to change. But as it stands today, it seems like a lot of buyers are just saying, "Okay, I was looking at 7.5. Now I'm looking at 6.5. That's enough for me. I'm ready to transact."
James, do you see any issues with affordability from the buy side standpoint?
Yes, I mean, certainly. This is one of the things that I've been watching, well, I guess for the last 2 years or so, particularly with co-ops, because co-ops, as most of your listeners know, have pretty strict requirements in terms of debt to income ratios. And so as mortgage rates push up, that basically dramatically increases the amount of income that the buyers need to make just to qualify for the purchase, let alone whether they want to purchase the property. And so if you look at monthly payments from a 3% mortgage to a 6.5, depending on maintenance, the total all-in payment is going to go up 30 to 40%. So you need to make 30 to 40% just to qualify to make to purchase that property, that you 30 to 40% more than you would have 2 years ago. So particularly for co-ops, you're seeing a thinning out of the buyer pool, and some of those buyers may get pushed into condos, which all the sequel are going to be more expensive, but there's at least room for them to take on more financing and actually purchase them versus the co-ops, which are increasingly becoming just a non-starter.
Interesting. Can I just want to follow up on that, because I think you bring up an interesting point, and that's typically when we talk about affordability, usually it's the other way around, right? It's the condos are really expensive because they have those high initial costs, which co-ops don't typically have. So usually co-ops are thought of as the more affordable route. But, you know, what you're suggesting is that the affordability issue hits the DTIs, which makes the co-op, you know, approval process a little bit trickier. And I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned early on that you're starting to see a little bit more aggressiveness on the buy side, a little bit more frisson, a little bit more competition between buyers trying to get into some of these units. And I'm curious, is it spread equally between co-ops and condos, or are you seeing sort of that the interest more on the condo side to kind of back up this affordability issue?
Anecdotally, I would say yes. I wouldn't say it's a dramatic change, because there's always going to be, you know, when I think about our typical co-op buyer, it's like a one bedroom for like $700,000 to $900,000. And that's a pretty, it's a deep market, but incrementally it has shrunk a little bit. But you're definitely seeing more activity in condos, whether, you know, the cash purchases, which you referenced earlier, that's been a large chunk of the transactions in Manhattan overall. But I think it's also important to, you know, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, but if you're looking at a 25% debt to income requirement, which is usually seen as the target for most co-ops, if your monthly payment goes up above that, you still have plenty of room to go buy a condo, because the banks will go up to like 40, 42%. So just because even with the higher purchase price on condos, you still have room to increase your budget despite the higher monthly payment and still transact at the condo. So I haven't really seen, it's hard to track pricing data on co-ops and control for all the other variables, but I wouldn't be surprised if we look back at this period of rising rates and we see the spread between condos and co-ops widen, just as more buyers get pushed into condos, should they want to buy. Obviously, they can just continue to rent or whatever else they're doing. But if they want to buy, a lot of buyers are getting pushed into condos.
No, it's interesting. I think you kind of stole my next question right out from under me. I was going to ask you about if you saw sort of a widening of that spread. Let me ask you kind of a follow up on that, a little bit of a demographic question. Does this affect the age skew, I suppose, of customers? Are you starting to see the younger customers go to condos because it's a little bit more, well, it's easier, I suppose, to get into that condo since it's only a financing issue and it's not a board approval issue?
Yes and no. I think the problem with that, or the opposing side of that, is, like you mentioned earlier, condos are more expensive. So if you're younger and you don't have a gift or a big promotion, big bonus, whatever, you just might not be able to do the condo. And that's even putting aside the higher closing costs on condos. So I think if anything, what you'll probably see is buyers just pare back their expectations on the co-ops that they would buy. So if they could afford a $900,000 one bedroom before, maybe they lower that to $800,000, just because that's what they need. That's all they can afford if they want to get approved by the board.
This is interesting stuff, James. I'm trying to put the pieces together up to this point and go over my checklist here. So it sounds like we're in a shifting marketplace. It sounds like you're of the belief the bottom was probably sometime in fall, and that we are rebounding right now as we speak off of those lows. You're starting to see more bidding war scenarios going on over there. You're starting to see properties that were not selling get a bid, which is anecdotal what I'm hearing. Yeah. And this is what's strange from my perspective. I'm talking to a lot of managers and other agents, and I'm hearing that too, that properties that were sitting are now getting a bid. A couple of questions come to mind before I go to my next question here on our list is, do you think sell side mindset is past that peak fear, peak desperation period right now? Are sellers getting a little more optimistic or tightening up a little bit?
I think it's more driven by the buy side. I think the seller's expectations haven't changed too much. They probably will, as this narrative, should it continue, circulates. But I don't think the sellers are getting more aggressive in their asks. I think it's the buyers meeting where they were just hanging out before and they sat on the market for 2, 3, 4 months, and then the market met them.
Yeah, so you're at a perfect transition period then right now, even for buyers. Like, they didn't miss it yet. They did not miss it. Like, we're getting clear data and clear stories here, anecdotal stories that this market's turning around, but there's still maybe some advantages there to take advantage of. And one more question. Yep. Are you noticing the penalty for unrenovated units? I know the penalty for unrenovated units was you don't get a bid.
Yep.
So is that starting to fade a little, in your opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen way more buyers be open to a renovation or just actually go forward with one, just because all of the pressures and constraints that we were facing over the last 3 years have started to alleviate. And it's just a much more, I mean, the cost, it's still expensive. So it's still going to trade at a pretty significant discount, and a lot of buyers just don't have the cash to do one. But I think what's getting people more willing to do a renovation is there's less uncertainty. Like, they generally know when the countertop's going to show up. They generally know when the contractor is going to start. They don't expect like their kitchen to cost 10 grand more just because of inflation over the last 6 months. So yeah, definitely less, less fear, frankly, around renovations than there was since COVID.
Interesting stuff. Now, enough about the market. Who wants to hear about the market anymore? I'd like to talk about something else about the market, but a different way. And I want to talk about the professional side of the market, which is getting the transactions and you know, working with leads. And one of the conversations that we'd had earlier revolved around leads. And you had some interesting ideas about essentially how to make them work. So James, tell us in a nutshell, how do you guys make leads work?
Yeah, well, I think just to frame the topic a little bit more, when we talk about leads, you're generally talking about buyers. So like, we'll have a lot of people come off of our website. They're just browsing and they find us, but we haven't actually spoken with them first. And at that point, you need to provide value. So you need to give them a reason to work with you. You need to show them that you're knowledgeable, that you're going to assist throughout the process. You're not just going to kind of push them into buying something for the first place they see. And I think the best way we've been able to do that, it's like, it's customer service 101, but it probably bears diving into a bit more, is just provide value. So when we go to the first showing, we'll have the comps ready. If there is a tax abatement, we'll know what the unabated property taxes would be and eventually will be. Just having all of these little nuggets in your back pocket and showing that you are a source of information that they can't find on whatever website they're searching on, that is a great way to build trust. And when someone trusts you, they're going to stick with you. And that's especially the whole real estate business. All the successful people that you have on your podcast, they built businesses based on trust. And I think a lot of agents are a little short-sighted. They just want to get the deal done. But the way to build repeat and referral business is to build that trust. One of the ways, another strategy I have, it's not really a strategy, I guess a strategy, if it's relevant, is point out all the things that are wrong with a property. Because if you give people reasons not to buy something, and it still might be the right one for them, but not every property is perfect. If you give them reasons not to buy something, they're going to go, oh, okay, well, maybe this person is actually looking out for my best interest and is going to highlight issues or shortfalls compared to other properties. So basically, just providing as much information as possible. That's the number one thing that we focus on for getting leads into clients.
I love how you said that, because there's an inherent bias, right, in the psychology of buyers and sellers when they're talking to agents, right? They immediately think that we're commission oriented. They immediately think that that's
where
they go into it knowing that. So I like the whole strategy of, well, let me just take a little time and show them that that is not the main thing on my mind. And that, you know, you being a happy customer and providing good service is on my mind. So I love that. Thank you for mentioning that. John, you have something on your mind here?
I got to jump in because it's a really interesting story. It's very apropos, but you know, a lot of people know, or maybe they don't know, that Noah and I originally met because Noah was my broker, my buyer broker, when I went to buy a place in New York City. And he was the only one of the people that I ever talked to that kind of understood the role of data and understanding, you know, because I'm coming from a financial background and I'm looking as data as the foundation for things. And I remember some of the very first showings that I went to with Noah, and he's like, I don't like this. I don't like this. These financials, there's something wrong here. And I'm like, That's interesting. I've probably had dozens of brokers this time, but I've never had someone say, I don't like this. It's always like, this is fantastic. And it was obviously it worked.
It
So
was my playbook. It was completely my playbook because
plus
I'm look,
one.
my degree is in psychology. I overanalyze things. It's my problem. It's my own problem. I'm slightly aware of it. But he's 100% right. He's 100% right that there is these inherent biases in the mindset and the psyche of these clients, and you really should address them because if they trust you, they will listen to you and they will be loyal to you and they will tell their friends and family about you. And this is how the businesses work. Anyway, excellent, excellent. We're running out of time. I got one more question, James. I know that you see a lot of data in your company. You see a lot of agents that succeed. You see agents that maybe are not succeeding to the same level as other agents. So I just want to ask you, do you see any consistency or commonalities, any traits that you're seeing in the successful side of agents versus those agents that are not really reaching where they want to go?
I think it kind of piggybacks off the last question, which is providing value, but also to provide value, you do need information. And so just being very knowledgeable about obviously specific properties, but the market, Urban Digs. Everyone listening to this, you should subscribe to Urban Digs because I use their data all the time. Because if you try to, for lack of a better term, if you try to BS somebody into making a decision that they're not comfortable with, it's going to backfire in a number of ways. And so you can provide the value and people can come to different conclusions based on the data. That's fine. But you need to have data, show people where the market is, show people the comps. I mean, there are tons of resources out there, publicly available resources that agents can use to provide more information that their clients probably were not even expecting. One of the things that comes up all the time, I'm shocked that it comes up as often as it does, is just pulling property tax bills. I mean, people always ask about property taxes, and you can do it on the Department of Finance's website in 30 seconds. So being able to do things like that, showing people the flood zone map. I had a client who bought in Bed-Stuy and he loved the place. His only complaint was that he wished he knew about a map that shows the noise from planes landing at JFK and LaGuardia, because one of the paths to LaGuardia went kind of over his place. It wasn't that bad, but these are sort of some things that you just pick up as you go throughout the business, and you just collect these little tools and you put them in your toolkit. But having all of these available, one, to know where the information is, and then also, I guess this is kind of related as well, is if you don't know something, just say you don't know and you'll get back to them. I think that will instill a lot more confidence with clients, more so buyers, because it's more on the spot and it's focused on multiple properties. But I'll see people and they'll just kind of be at an open house and be like, yeah, I think this is underpriced, and or I think this is overpriced, but really, you need to look at the comps. So knowing what you know, what you don't know, and where to find the information that you don't know, that's a very succinct way I would summarize what the agents that outperform do better.
Invest in knowledge, invest in resources. After all, you are a market expert, right? That buyer or seller wants you to have that information. So you got to make yourself smarter and you got to get that information. And can I just say one more thing? I don't know. What an underrated response. Let me research and get back to you. I don't know the answer to that. Because a
I've
lot of
gotten multiple people. They're like, thank you, that's the right response.
a lot of agents will feel
It's
this
hard.
need. Yeah, this need to have to give an answer, even if they don't quite know the answer, because they're in this role of advisor and expertise, and you should never answer something that you don't know about. Just right off the bat, don't even worry about it. Don't stress. Don't get scared. Don't get nervous. Just say, I don't know. Let me research it, and I will get right back to you. And that's you pull that out of your pocket, and have it whenever you want. Awesome, awesome. John, you have any final questions for James?
No, it was terrific, James. I appreciate it very much. And I think everything
Yeah,
you
my
mentioned, a
pleasure.
number of resources, we'll put those in the link so people below can, here's where you go to Department of Finance to pull a property tax bill. Here's a flood map. So I thank you for those. We'll make a list of some of those, and hopefully that helps some agents out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Thanks for
And
having me on.
yeah, and thanks for fitting the whole market intelligence and the productivity strategies and all that format to this show. I hope that agents will appreciate this. I know that they will they probably learned something. And if they did, reach out to James, say thank you, say hi. It's always good to make new contacts. You never know when it's going to help you close a deal. And James, thank you very much. That is James McGrath, co-founder, principal over at Urivo. That is John Walkup. I am Noah Rosenblatt. This has been Talking Manhattan over at Urban Digs, and we will catch you guys next time. Thank you, James.
Thank you.